And I have the pleasure to have met Alan at the Depot Group. He came in and sort of slouched down into a chair, and he just laid back in there, and every now and then he spoke. I was sort of like, who is this guy? And every now and then he spoke, and when he spoke, some things came out. He just kept hitting me right where I lived every time he said something. So can't guarantee that's going to happen today. I don't want to build it up that much, but I'll tell you, I've really enjoyed getting to know Alan over these last several years. So with no further ado, Alan Sahee from the Depot Group. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Alan. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I wish Damon had asked you not to throw things, too. Anyway, I always have to think for a second before I start talking. All right, that's enough. April 1st, 1988, Port Authority, New York City, waiting to get on a bus. I had a Tall Boy Budweiser, and that was the last drink I've had. And leading up to that, it was kind of an interesting affair of putting myself through hell. And leading away from that, it's been a pretty interesting affair of leading myself towards serenity. So I'll get to the part where we get up to that point, and I'll go through that pretty quickly, and then talk more about sobriety than I do about my story of being a drunk. I was born in Texas to fairly religious parents, or fairly church-going parents. I don't know whether it was religious or not, but probably in church the first time in my life, the first time my mom was able to get up out of bed and go to church after I was born, and went every Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and prayer meeting that they had at that church wherever we lived until I left home. And I could not tell you that I got a whole lot of God out of that. I could tell you that I got a whole lot of odd conceptions of God, or what I think now to me are odd conceptions of God. And it was more that the notion that somehow or another God is watching me all the time, trying to go, got you again. And that didn't really work for me. So I pretty well rejected that notion of God. And, I kind of put up with it at home because I was in my parents' house and that's what you were going to do. But I don't think I really believed any of the stuff that I was hearing. I could be, there were certainly things that I absorbed and that I thought about and that entered me that still are reflected in my view of God today. But they're not, they've been kind of changed a lot by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to be something more that helps me be sober than something that that I'm trying to run away from. So anyway, grew up in Texas. Was an alcoholic from the day I was born, and I know that because I was a miserable kid. I mean, not happy at all. I did not like people. I didn't feel like I fit in. I just spend as much time alone as I could. Was weird, and I know people thought that of me, and I kind of thought it of myself. And I can't tell you when I had my first drink. I don't really remember, but I do remember I remember the first time that I had a drink that it meant something to me. I was at a party, and to kind of describe my state of mind, really the way that I was, I was that kid that you read about that's on top of the school shooting people. Okay, I never got there, but that was my state of mind. I could have done that, and I think to myself, God, it's pure luck that I never, decided to drive into school one day with a rifle and kill the people that I didn't like, because I didn't like anybody, and I didn't think they liked me either. So And I thought a lot about, taking my vengeance on these people that hate me, and I'd never actually spoken to them to find out whether they like me or not. So that's kind of the state of mind that I lived in So I'm at this party, and I'm with all these people that I'm telling myself I don't like, and just, you know, in my mind going, you know, he's a jerk, he's a whatever, she's a this, da, da, da. And I had a beer, and all of a sudden, all those people that I hated became wonderful. And I became okay, too. And it was all right to be me. And to be very honest with you, that was the last time that ever really happened with drinking. It was that one time. But you know what? I chased that for a long time. And I chased it through pretty low depths. But I liked it. Man, did it wasn't... I liked drinking, but I liked that feeling that all of a sudden I belong with the rest of these people. That I'm somehow or another attached to them. And that was my introduction to drinking as I said, as I remember it. I mean, I think there were a couple of other times that I might have had a shot of whiskey or something with one of my uncles trying to, you know, wanting to show me how awful it was or something like that, because I do remember at least once drinking some whiskey and going, damn, I don't know why anybody drinks that, but because it didn't taste good. So introduction to drinking, I really liked it, and then I went off on a chase on that. As I said, I grew up in Texas. I ended up going into the Navy, staying in the Navy for about a year and a half, going through nuclear power school in Orlando, figuring out that these people wanted to put me on a ship and make me go out and sail around under the ocean for a while, and thinking that I needed to get myself out of this. So I told them I was claustrophobic, and they said, okay, well, you can't go on a ship, and I got out of the Navy. I was in upstate New York at that time, and I kind of liked it up there. I mean, when I left Texas, my intent was to never, ever, 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 ever go back, and that I didn't like that either. You will notice that there is this theme in my talking of all kinds of things I didn't like. So I did like upstate New York, and there was a girl up there that I liked a lot, and I stayed there to chase her around. My parents owned a restaurant when I was growing up. It was like a Dairy Queen. It was called the Dairy Mart, same sort of thing. I cooked, starting when I was about 12 years old. And I went back to work in the restaurant business. And I could tell you, one of the things about the restaurant business that makes it a good business to be in if you're drunk is a lot of times they don't care. You know, as long as you can still kind of function, particularly in the kitchen, if you can still get the food out, I don't care if you're drunk. You know, don't cut your hands off in my place. I don't want to pay the, I don't want to do the paperwork. But other than that, go right ahead. And every place I worked pretty much after that, I had at least one waiter trained to bring me some alcohol. So went back to work, went to work in the restaurant business, moved to New York City, and stayed working in the restaurant business. The first job I had there was in a hotel, and I was in the hotel workers union, and that was a great union because part of the contract was they had to give you two beers a shift. And anything else they did made no difference to me. The people I worked for had to make sure I got two beers a shift. The kind of beer that they gave you, I think, was Schaefer or Schmitz, one or the other. And nobody else liked it, and I didn't really care. You know, so they'd bring you down a bucket full of beer for the whole kitchen, and three quarters of the guys wouldn't touch that stuff, but I would. So it was okay with me because I got everybody else's two beers too. And after I got to New York, I mean, it's funny because I grew up in this little town in Texas. I moved to New York City, and I walked around and said, this is where I was supposed to be. I mean, I liked New York. I liked it a lot. If any of you have been there, you will know what I'm about to say is true. If you can't find it in New York, it ain't there. Okay? Whatever kind of fun you like, you can find there and a whole lot of it. And I like to drink, and, you know, there's a lot of watering holes in New York. And so worked in the restaurant business still. I slowly but surely got myself into a very, very bad crowd of people. Started running with some guys that were probably living most of their lives illegally, and I started hanging out with them, and I started doing a lot of things that people that live most of their life illegally do. Probably the low point of my working career was to be had a buddy who was a fairly big cocaine dealer, and I used to collect money for him. And most of the things that they show you on TV or whatever about going and collecting money for a cocaine dealer are not even close to accurate. I mean, I used to often have to throw clothes away because they had way too much blood on them. And as far as I know, and I hardly have ever talked about this part of my story until recently because now the statute of limitations is long up on anything that could have happened. As far as I know, nobody ever got killed. There are a lot of people that ended up with broken bones and no teeth and hurt in bad, bad ways that I'm not really proud of, but you know, it's funny that I can look at myself and say I went on this trajectory of being somebody who didn't like somebody to being somebody who acted out not liking people, and to finally reaching the point after, you know, as I continued in my drinking career, of being somebody who had no soul. I mean, who had just given it up. On the other side of that, in the kitchen, I worked as a cook most places. I was very ambitious, and my ambition was rewarded. I'm pretty good at what I do. I have to, again, tell you, I killed a lot of talent with alcohol, and I can remember at a time being able to do stuff that I can't even think about doing now. You know, is culinary techniques. I mean, I can see them, I can recognize them, I just can't do them. And I think to myself, I used to be able to do that, but, you know, I used to be able to do a lot of things that that by the time I got done drinking that I can't do today. And they won't come back. I mean, I practiced, I tried, they won't come back. I've kind of had to accept that. You know, I did that to myself, though. But, so on the kitchen aspect of it, I was ambitious, and I had some talent, and I had some people that were interested in helping me along in my career. I would take jobs that I had absolutely no right to take and then just learn to do them, you know, and then go find something else and do that again. I had people that were, you know, interested in opening restaurants in New York that were, you know, talking to people that were going to put millions and millions of dollars into these places. Two times I got trotted out to a meeting as the person that they were going to bring in as their chef at a restaurant where they were having an investors meeting, and both of those times I walked in the door just absolutely stumbling, falling down drunk. And after the first one, I'm kind of surprised the second one happened. If you want to know, you know, honestly, I can't imagine running me out there again like that. But you know, after the second one of those, trust me, another one didn't happen. My career had in that business had really gone, you know, a pretty meteoric rise. Had knew a lot of people in the business, had a lot of people that liked me, that were friendly with me, that would do things for me. After that, about that second time, all of a sudden my career in that business started going almost straight down. And you know, I went from that to working at a little, like, corner bar, working the grill in a corner bar, cooking hamburgers. Then I would quit drinking, and my career would again kind of start taking a. And the truth, I'd quit drinking because I knew drinking was causing me my problems, but I didn't want to quit drinking. I just wanted to quit having problems. So I'd quit drinking for a little while, so that I could, you know, get myself back on my feet or whatever. And it was funny because I'd quit drinking and things would start coming back together for me pretty quickly. It's odd how fast people forget the bad things you do to them. You know, that you can go back to somebody and trust me, they all knew that it was drinking too. There was nobody that this was a big secret from. And I'd go back and talk to somebody and, well, you know, I haven't had a drink and da 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 da. Oh, really? All of a sudden I turned into a different person and they would start talking to me again. And, you know, I'd go back and work somewhere that I'd be making a lot more money than I had by flipping hamburgers in the corner bar. And after a very short period of that, I'd start thinking, well, you know, I think I've got this whip because my life's coming back together. And I'd, you know, usually start out with, I would usually actually start out with a little pattern of the nose. And then after that, I am almost purely an alcoholic. Anything else that I ever did was an addendum to drinking. I did like stimulant drugs because if I was using them, I could stay up and drink more. And that was pretty much the point of it. And if I ever did anything else, I mean, I could tell you something. If marijuana was the only thing available, I would stay sober. I didn't like it a bit. But anything that was a stimulating drug, I was interested in because I could stay up and drink for days that way. And that was it did work for me that way. But however I would end up deciding that it was time to take a drink again, I would make that decision. And I'd take a drink again, and I would see myself on this kind of gradual climb back into a decent lifestyle, and it would go whoom to the point that I ended up was working at a little restaurant on 2nd Avenue in New York, and I was sleeping in the basement of the restaurant in the boiler room on a board that was stuck in between two chairs, and I'd get up in the morning and I would go take a bath in the bathroom of the restaurant and then go to work. And they made sure to inform me that all the alarms in the restaurant were on, so that if I went out in the restaurant during the day or during the night anywhere near the bar, that all the alarms would go off, and that the, you know, and I never tried it, and that's kind of amazing to me, because I can't believe that would really have slowed me down at that point, because I really needed to drink. I mean, I would tell myself at that point, I'm not going to drink. And the first time alcohol was available to me, I would drink. I couldn't stop myself. I'd gone past the part where I could quit. You know, I remembered being able to do that. You know, okay, I can stop drinking for a while and get my life back together. But I had stopped being able to make myself quit drinking. Couldn't do it. The other thing that was kind of surprising to me is I would go on, you know, every time things would get lower for me, every time things would get worse, I could make that be okay with me. I could be laying on my board in between two chairs in a boiler room with a dirt floor, with no place to go, and think, you know, this isn't so bad. This is all right. I've chosen to be here. You know, this is okay with me. I could lower my standards to wherever I was, in other words. You know, throw the dart at the wall and draw the board around it. Say I'd hit a bullseye. That was my that was my way of living my life. I remember this when I was working at that place, there was a guy that I knew, and was talking to him and his girlfriend, and she expressed some sympathy for my situation. I don't recall being that angry very often in my life, that somebody would feel sorry for me, because I was living in the freaking basement of a place, sleeping on a board. I was furiously angry that somebody thought that there was some reason to feel sorry for me for that. Got myself back into another very bad state of mind, in other words. I had no conception of reality. You know, I mean, I had a conception of the reality that I perceived, and I, you know, I could always make whatever was going on be okay with me, but I had no perception of reality as it was to, you know, the rest of the world looked at this and said, what a mess, you know, how have you gotten yourself this way? You know, the people that I worked for in that other business I talked about didn't trust me very much either, and they shouldn't have. You know, I was the kind of guy that gets a lot of people arrested, not just me. So I didn't get very much work out of that either anymore. And so the money kind of dried up, and the respect of anyone that I knew had dried up. And my humanity had gone. I had become, I mean, the best way I can describe it is I'd become a bag of broken glass. There was nothing left. You know, and it all hurt. And alcohol didn't work anymore. And any drugs that I used didn't work anymore. And I had nothing left. I couldn't do the things that, you know, that made me valuable to myself. Sadly, I mean, I could tell you that through this time, you know, there were girlfriends, there were places to live, there was stuff, there were cars, there were, you know, all those kind of things. Every single one of those I was willing to sacrifice to be able to drink. You know, if a job got in the way of me drinking, often I would sacrifice the job. If a relationship got in the way of me drinking, the relationship had to go away. If paying the rent got in the way of me drinking, you know, the rent went away. And I would be willing to, you know, figure out how to couch surf or whatever to be able to keep myself drinking. But through pretty much all of that, I had been able to at least work. And let's go all the way back to Texas, where one of my concepts of myself was, you know, I compared myself to my father, who is, I still don't compare well to him. he's a great guy. And, but tremendous work ethic. And that's part of what I had always, you know, seen a man to be. And I got where I couldn't work. And I will tell you, I think this is kind of a sad thing now that, you know, that the thing I valued most was my ability to get up and go to work in the morning and earn a living. I valued it for another reason. When you don't have any money, it's hard to drink. You know, so there was really an ulterior motive to that. But the part of me that said, that's what makes me be okay. You know, I couldn't do that anymore. That was the bottom of me. I ended up sitting by the East River in New York City in a pretty bad bind. I mean, I had gone to AA. I'd sat in meetings. I said this many, many times. I walked into an AA room. Yes, there's the steps. Okay, yeah, one, I can do that. I'm pretty powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. I knew that. Two, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could assure us the sanity. I know there's a God. I don't trust him very much, but I know he's there. Turning my will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I could consider that, but whatever. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That didn't sound too bad to me either. And I had kind of a problem with that, though. You know that word moral in there? I didn't have any. Let's get down to five. Admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I'll do it with myself. I'll do it with God. If there's another person involved, I'm not talking. Okay? So, five is out. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, if I really thought about it, that step, I would think to myself, you know, what is God going to do to all these other people? You know, because it's certainly not talking about me. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Okay, how's he, you know, I'll ask him 100 times to fix everybody else. Made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. That was okay. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I ain't doing that either. Continue to make current. Okay, you're kind of getting the picture, right? I wasn't doing all those. And the ones that I could do, I couldn't do. Because I didn't know what they meant. I remember getting the big book and reading it and going, what the heck is this guy talking about? What does this mean? I couldn't understand it. It was crazy. So anyway, had been to AA. Had an idea of what AA was. Had an idea. I didn't know what it was. Don't get that. Don't get me wrong there. I'm not telling you that I knew anything about AA. I had an idea. I knew that I couldn't drink. I couldn't imagine living without drinking. I wasn't going to die, and I couldn't kill myself. I was in a hell of a spot. I mean, terrible. Unbelievable misery. And out of that unbelievable misery, I said a 3-word prayer. And I said, God, help me. And I had prayed a lot while I was drinking. You know, the foxhole prayers, I'll never do this again. Get me out of this. Please help me. And God did his part pretty often, you know. I didn't do my part, but he was pretty faithful about doing his. But I said a 3-word prayer, God help me. And I did not direct him as to how to help me. And that's also another bad fault of mine. God, please do this, 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 and this for me. And do it right now. And give me some patience, too. which doesn't work out very well, except for that patience part. Never pray for patience, by the way. Never, ever pray for patience. But so I had a friend of mine, this person who was the cocaine dealer that I talked about, had gotten sober about a year and a half before this point. And he had talked to me about sobriety a lot. And he mentioned to me that I should go to this place called Graymore, which is upstate from New York City. It is a homeless men's shelter. I was a homeless man. But I thought that I was going to go to a rehab and that they were going to fix me. Okay, that's my conception of this, was that somehow or another somebody was going to tap me with a magic wand and I was going to be fixed and everything was going to be wonderful. So that's how I ended up in the Port Authority with that tall boy bud, going up to Graymore, which turned out to be a homeless men's shelter. I got there, as I said, homeless men's shelter, I'm a homeless man, sounds like we fit together. I was madder than heck about being there. Did not want to be at a homeless men's shelter, but I stayed. Didn't want to do the next thing that was asked of me to do. Kicking and screaming. Angry, angry, angry. But I did it. So that meant that I did go to a rehab. And I didn't want to go. And then they wanted to send me to a halfway house. And they had two halfway houses. And I wanted to go to one. And I didn't want to go to the other. So which one did I go to? The one I didn't want to go to. Kicking and screaming. Mad, mad, mad. Now, went to this... went to the homeless or to the halfway house I didn't want to go to, was getting out of it. They had told me that I could actually go back and work in restaurants, which was good. It was the thing I was still kind of able to do. And the first restaurant I worked at, the second person I met was a girl that came by and said, "Hi, my name's Tammy. Can I get you a cup of coffee?" And so we've been married for 18 years, and I didn't want to go there. You know, I didn't want to go to that halfway house. And I didn't want to go to this place where they sent me. And I didn't want to do a lot of the things that were asking me to be done. But I did do them. Because somehow, in that three-word prayer that I said, it had occurred to me that I don't know what I'm doing. And I need to listen to somebody else. And I will tell you something. You don't have to be happy about what you're doing. You don't have to walk up and go, "Wow, I really, 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 really want to go tell that old boss of mine that I used to steal a bunch of stuff from him, and I need to give it back to him." Okay? I didn't feel happy about doing that when I did it. It didn't make me sit and think, "Oh, this is going to be the best day of my life." I was scared. I was not, you know, I also didn't want to give the stuff back. You know, I'd gotten away with that. But, you know, you don't have to be happy about doing it. What will happen, though, is if you do the things that it takes to be sober, you'll become happy about them. They'll get easier. Because the reason I wasn't happy about it, I told you before, I've led this whole story up to the point where I told you I was freaking crazy. How could a crazy guy be happy about doing so, you know, sane and sober things? They don't look real to me. They didn't look like the right thing, and they scared me. Now, I never get afraid, I get mad. Now, my reaction to fear is to be angry. So anytime I'm mad, all I have to do is look around for what I'm afraid of. And if I, you know, look around for what I'm afraid of and acknowledge it as fear, my anger goes away. You know, I've learned that trick a long time ago, but it took me a long time to learn it. Anyway, let's go through the steps real quick. So I told you, I knew I was an alcoholic, and I knew my life was unmanageable. It took me a little while to get where I could come to believe that there was a power greater than myself who would restore me to sanity. Not that he could, who would. That was really my problem. That I had pushed God so far away from myself that I couldn't see that he would have anything to do with me. But when I got it, I mean, when I just started to, you know, came to believe over that period of time. It wasn't that hard for me to get to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him at that point also wasn't hard. Developing a set of morals so that I could do a fearless and searching moral inventory was a different thing too. I really, really had to have help with that. I worked very hard with my sponsor, but and he asked me a lot of questions. Did you, you know, and what happened next? And how did that happen? And how did you, you know, and how did you feel about that? And that, and to have somebody kind of sit down with me and say, you know what? I know you didn't feel like that was wrong, but that was wrong. You know, one other little part of this that was kind of, that I think is, I haven't really touched on. I mean, I got into a rehab, spent a lot of time talking to psychologists and these people there. And one of the things that came out of that thing is, you know, I'm a diagnosed sociopath at that point. And truthfully, most of the stuff I didn't care about at that time. I did terrible, awful things to other people. If you know, what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine, as long as I can get it away from you, was my philosophy. And if it hurts you really badly for me to take it away from you, I don't care about that either. And I had that, none of that stuff ever bothered me. One of the bad moments of your life, if you live your life that way, is when you wake up one morning and you have a conscience. Because I'd never had one, and I woke up one morning and I had a conscience. But that, I mean, the nice part about that is, of course, you know, I don't get to be a sociopath anymore. That's okay with me. I don't mind that. Don't take it that I think that being a sociopath was a good thing. I'm just telling you it's the way it was. I woke up one morning and all the stuff that didn't bother me, all the stuff that I thought was okay, all the stuff, I mean, all the ways that I had taken my life and made what I, you know, drawn the dartboard around the dart, all of a sudden I noticed that the dartboard is way over here and that I've just been playing this game with myself. And I got a conscience and it hurt. And I didn't like it. Again, I didn't like it. But I knew some things to do about it. And I started doing those things. And that's where you get to 5, admit to God, yourself, and another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. Okay, now I've gotten the stuff out on the table. I know what it is. I know how I got where I am. I know why I'm in this kind of awful ball of pain right now. And I can start to do something about it. So after I get past 5, I know how I got there. I get to 6 and I say, I'm going to ask God to remove all these defects of character. The ones that made me, I mean, the things that I did to myself to make me be who I am. I'm going to ask God to do something about. That's 6 and 7. Made a list of the people I'd harmed. Became willing to make amends to them all. I'll tell you what, there's no... I knew I could. I had when I quit drinking. The nice thing about it is that tall boy Budweiser that I had. I knew that was the last drink I was ever going to have. I don't know that standing here today. I'm sorry. I don't have that kind of confidence in myself as I did, you know, being crazy. But I knew that I didn't plan to drink anymore after that. So I, you know, back to getting to 8. I didn't have drinking, drugs, crazy. Any of those things to get, you know, to make the pain of this go away. So I had to do actually the right thing, which was to find out the people I'd hurt and then to go do something about it. And I've had to track a lot of people down about a lot of different things. And either, I mean, as simple as I as tell you I'm sorry to as complex as emptying a bank account, you know, to this, to take care of things. One of the more fun ones. Part of my career, I'd moved out to Cape Cod, and anytime I left New York City, there was a DWI in the offing. So I went to Cape Cod and got a DWI pretty quick. And my response to that, of course, was to leave and go back to New York. And you know, those people in the courts, they just don't forget. So. No, but anyway, part of my 8th and 9th step was to, I'm writing this down, and my sponsor's looking at it, and he said, did you ever do anything about that? No. Don't you think you ought to? No, I don't. I think that I got away with it. Okay, you think you ought to, don't you? Yes, I do. Okay, so I had gotten a lawyer when I originally did this, so I called him. Now, the lawyer still wants his $400 or whatever it was that I didn't pay him. All right, let me mail you a check. Here's your $400. You need to come back. Well, what's going to happen when I get back? Don't know. Depends on, you know, what kind of day the judge is having. He can do anything he wants to you at this point. But you need to come back and get this cleared up. Off I trot. And by this time, I'm married, by the way. And my wife went out to Cape Cod with me. And she had asked me, you know, what's going to happen? I really don't know. You know, I can either pay a fine or I can go to jail. Which, you know, whatever is their pleasure. And, you know, the lawyer that I'd spoken to told me I needed to bring quite a bit of money with me in cash because they weren't going to take a check. And be ready also if I needed to you know, go sit in a little gray bar hotel for a little while. So got there and got up in front of the judge and Mr. Clark, we've missed you for the last few years. Where have you been? And, you know, I kind of told him that I'd been away and avoiding him and had gotten sober in the meantime. That was a really good thing to tell him. And I expected to have to pay them a couple of $1,000, and I think I paid a $200 fine and got told to, you know, get my driving privileges in Massachusetts reinstated, and that, you know, he was proud of me for coming back and doing that. And I was kind of surprised by that, but, you know, that's kind of an example of doing something in your night step that you can, they don't always turn out that way. There are people that you go back and you talk to and, you know, I did this, this, and this, and I'm really sorry and I want to make amends to you, and you can be lucky to get out the door with your skin on sometimes, because the guy that you got away with it with, he doesn't want to know about that. He wants to know how he can kill you at this point. And I've had that happen too. So, you know, I mean, as I said, it doesn't always work out. You know, the sun comes out and the rainbow comes out and an angel comes and kisses you on both cheeks and you're all so happy. Sometimes it's not that pretty thing. But what it does for me, what it did for me, what it continues to do for me when I get the opportunity to make amends for something is that I get to live with myself. I get to wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and go, that's okay. It's okay to be that guy. And I couldn't do that for a lot of my life. So 10, 11, and 12. And most of my life now is, you know, 10, 11, and 12. That every day I take an inventory of myself. I look at how I live my life. And I try to live my life in a way that I can go to sleep at night and sleep and not worry and don't intentionally try to hurt somebody else. And, you know, a lot of times we hurt other people without it being our intention. But when I do that, to make sure that I go tell them that wasn't what I meant to do. And if it did hurt you, I'm sorry. And if it hurt you in a way that I can do something about, actually do something about, I'll do that too. Then to, 11 and 12. 11 is one of my favorite steps, and for a couple of reasons. One, I could tell you, 5 years sober, up until 5 years sober, I would say the Serenity Prayer because we say it a lot at meetings, but I never meant one word of it. I did not want any serenity. I wanted, you know, God grant me all the chaos that I can have around me so people don't notice me, and so that I can hide in that and that I can, you know, I can have things to think about besides myself. You know, give me another mess to clean up, and if there's not one here, let me make one so I can clean it up and be a hero, any of those sorts of things. I didn't want any serenity. I didn't know what still didn't feel right to me to not have anything going on inside of me. And the other thing is, you know, and I kind of touched on this a little bit. Large part of my early sobriety, I was consumed with anger. Consumed with it, just mad about everything. And I talked about, you know, I didn't want to go to that, didn't want to stay at that that shelter, didn't want to go to the rehab, didn't want to go to the halfway house, didn't want to get up and go to work, didn't want to do what I was doing here, didn't want to, and mad about it. But the thing was, you know, anger was still one of the things that made me feel alive. I had a conception of God, had some kind of relationship with Him, but it wasn't really close, to be honest with you. And that was just my way of feeling alive. Now, somewhere, I was around 5 years sober, I started, despite myself, to get these little moments of serenity. Not long. Not sought, really. You hang around AA long enough, you stay sober long enough, you do the things you're supposed to do long enough, no matter how mad or how bad you try to create chaos, every once in a while you'll get some serenity. And I was pleasantly surprised. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know, that's a hard thing for me to describe, how I went through this process, because I still don't exactly have it kind of worked out in my mind. I just know that at a certain point, I didn't want to be mad anymore, and I didn't want chaos anymore. And I didn't want a lot of crap in my life. And I started saying the surrender prayer and meaning it. And I started seeking God and meaning it. Not seeking God so I could argue with Him. And that was really a big point of me, my relationship with God early in my sobriety was just to argue with what I thought He wanted me to do and try to make my point. And kind of started to get over that. And okay, I still kind of like to make my point, but I don't have to. And develop that serenity, develop a relationship, and have my conception of God be completely different than it was when I was a kid. What I'd say is what I grew up with, the concept of God I had growing up was a God who was a God of justice, which means you get what, you get paid back for what you do. And I think that there is justice. I do believe that. But obviously, from some of the things I've told you, I don't want to get paid back for what I did. I would have to be dead, and I don't want to be dead. I don't have any desire for that anymore. I could tell you that for a large part of my drinking, people would tell me, if you keep this up, it's going to kill you. And my response to that was, when? When is it going to kill me? I'm ready to go. But it didn't do it. So, have gone from a God of justice to one that's more of a God of grace that gives me the ability to do in my day what I need to do and the room to make mistakes and forgive me for them. That's pretty nice for me. And then the last part of that, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. One of the things I've discovered in my life is that if it's really, 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 really hard for me to do, God probably doesn't want me to do it. I mean, I'm not telling you He doesn't present you with challenges. That would be totally false. What I will tell you is that if you pray for God's will and the power to carry it out, and you do what is His will for you, that a lot of things that look really, really, really like they're going to be hard are pretty easy, because that's what God wants you to do. And He opens the path for you, and He lets you be able to do that. So a lot of times when I'm struggling and something's like, it's just not working out. Okay, that's the point when I have to go and wander into a bathroom or my bedroom or somewhere where there's a mirror anyway and look at it and say, oh yeah, you're still not God. that's right. The reason this is hard is because you want to do it. And doors aren't being opened for you. So that's, learning to feel that, the difference between my will and His, and to conform my will to His. Conforming your will to His so that things, almost all of life is easy when you do that. And that doesn't mean that it's all going to be pleasant or it's all going to be stuff that I like or that I enjoy or that sort of stuff. But I can, when my will is conformed to the will of the God as I understand Him, and I know I'm not running the show, and I know that things are going to work out for me if I just keep walking down the road that I'm on, life's wonderful. And since it's been a long time since I've had a drink, it's It's been a long time since I've spent an entire day in a rage. It's been a long time since I've decided that I needed to clean somebody's safe out or take all their whatever. It's been a long time since I've hit anyone. It's been a long time since I've fooled around with somebody's girlfriend. It's been a long time since I, you know, a lot of these things that used to be fairly commonplace for me. And I don't miss them. You know, they don't, they wouldn't enhance my life now. And they used to be what I lived for. I mean, I'll call it what I think it is. I lived to be evil at one point. I mean, it was the thing that called me. And putting the drink down and coming to AA and working the steps and getting a sponsor and knowing people here and caring about people here and becoming a member of the human race and getting a conscience and joining society and having a God and wanting to please Him have made my life be something I never imagined that it would. And I can tell you sincerely that if I had gotten everything I wanted in my first year of sobriety, one, I would still be trying to get rid of most of it because I had no idea. And two, the stuff that I didn't want, that I would have, you know, thought of as less than or less worthwhile than the things I wanted, would be the things I'd be seeking very hard now. Another nice thing about sobriety, I remember early on in sobriety telling my sponsor, "This is so freaking boring. You know, when is something exciting going to happen?" And he told me, "You know what? It will not be very long till you're going to wish you had another 3 or 4 hours a day." And anytime anybody asks me if they could do anything for me, I tell them, "If you give me another 4 hours a day or another arm, I'd be pretty happy with that because that's what I need. It's not boring anymore. As a matter of fact, I could go for a little boring." So sobriety is always different. My life and what I think about being sober and how I want to be is nothing like it was early in sobriety. It's also almost nothing like it was a couple of years ago. You know, it keeps changing. And that's a good thing because it keeps getting better. You know, and again, I'll tell you what, it's not me, you know, deciding, you know, throwing the dart and drawing the thing around and going, "Oh, this is what good is." I keep getting closer to where the real dartboard really is, and it's better. You know, it's better all the time. And, you know, wherever any of you are in your sobriety, you know, thank God that you're there and thank God that you're going. You know, that's all I can say. Because it continually improves. Continually. Thanks for letting me speak.